Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. I am James Serene. I'm delighted to be in Jerusalem with Bicom's Israel team, or some of Bicom's Israel team. Richard Pater, our director in Israel, and Neri Zilber, our senior research fellow. Welcome, gentlemen. It's great to be with you.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, welcome back, James.
So really what I wanted to focus on for this week is to dwell on a publication, a research paper that we published called The Middle East in 2020. This is something Bicom does every year. Our regular followers and fans will know that every year around this time, we predict what is going to happen in the Middle East in the year ahead. Some would say that is a fool's errand in a region as complex and unpredictable as the Middle East, but we try and predict the unpredictable, and we set out what we think is going to happen in the year ahead, and we make some bold predictions around what will happen in Israel and neighboring countries, in Iran, etc. And this year's sort of key author of the document has been Neri Zilber. So Neri, you were the lead author on the document. What really struck you when you were looking at the Middle East in the year ahead?
Look, there's predictions in the Middle East and there's also analysis in the Middle East. And what this document tries to do is incorporate both of those aspects and to look ahead at what key stakeholders, policymakers, and the general public need to be looking for in the coming 12 months, given what we've seen over the past 12 months. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's the Israeli political impasse domestically here. There's Israel's regional strategy in terms of Iran and other non-state actors that are arrayed against it. And then various key states and everything that's happening in those key states, both domestic, internal, mm-hmm. as well as in the regional context. Mm-hmm. So obviously Iran, the first chapter is on Iran, both its nuclear program, domestic economy, given the U.S. Maximum pressure campaign, and then its regional adventurism. Mm-hmm. So that in a nutshell is the prism through which we viewed this report and the analysis and then the predictions, which is internal, regional, and then also international aspects coming and impacting everything happening in the region.
And on the U.S. and Iran, I mean, we sort of concluded that there's going to be more of the same, and that Iran may continue to violate the nuclear deal, America will continue to impose sanctions, it won't do anything against Iran militarily, and it'll just sort of simmer on. So, I mean, could you expand on that a bit?
Sure. It's more of the same with a high potential of miscalculation and escalation. But really, neither side wants to enter into a war. Mm. Iran both wants to muddle through. It's under massive economic pressure. We saw the protests there over the last month and a half, which they seem to have succeeded in getting a hold over. And so they want to essentially try to wait out the Trump administration. Mm. They only have 12 more months of this to go. Mm. If you were a betting man, which you shouldn't be, but if you were, there's a high potential of a Democratic candidate being a lot more amenable to Iran's position, to perhaps returning America to the JCPOA nuclear agreement, and so on and so forth. So that's on the Iranian side. On the American side, you see a ramping up of the maximum pressure campaign, but it is primarily sanctions, primarily economic. Mm. And we go into detail in the report what you've seen from Trump over the past 12 months, and this is forecasting out to the coming 12 months, is that he does not want to use military force. Mm. So you saw Iran and various proxy allies of Iran attack Western interests in the Middle East, really start to do this in mid-2019. Mm. You had the attacks on the Saudi oil facilities, on Gulf shipping, oil tankers. You had attacks from Syria directed at Israel. So all that being said, America itself doesn't really want to escalate. Trump administration doesn't want to escalate. So taking that together, you may see them try to muddle through, but we don't expect a real renegotiation or entering into talks of this kind of new and improved JCPOA, because really for neither side, they have an interest in doing that at the moment.
Mm. I mean, that's the Iranian strategy struck me as quite short-sighted in a way, because, I mean, what if the Democrats don't win? And, I mean, I'm sure they are thinking very hard about what a second Trump term looks like for them. But, I mean, it doesn't look very good, although I presume at some point they would have to then concede and enter into some kind of negotiation, hopeful that Trump's record so far in these kinds of negotiations is very poor.
Right. It's interesting what, you know, how Iran wants to play it out. But so far, we go into analysis of what they've done so far and then try to project ahead.
Mm.
Despite the economic pressure arrayed against it, and it's significant, shouldn't be understated. They still have tools in their toolbox to apply reverse pressure and apply reverse deterrence on America, on its Middle Eastern allies.
Yeah.
And also it comes into play with respect to Israel.
Mm.
So we might see, for instance, attacks on shipping and various naval assets from the Red Sea.
Yeah.
The Houthis and perhaps others.
Mm.
You may see kind of longer range missile and rocket strikes from Iraq onto Israel, where Israel's ability to strike back, to find the guilty party and to strike back is a lot more limited because it's not in its immediate neighborhood, which is usually Lebanon or Syria or Gaza. So Iran has options, but they are feeling the pressure.
Yeah.
And that's where the risk of miscalculation comes in.
Let's talk a little bit about the Israel-Iran conflict. I know this is something that our listeners will be really interested to hear about. We've been looking very carefully at what's been going on. Essentially, it's an intense conflict between Israel and Iran over Syria. Last year, we predicted that would expand potentially into Iraq. That has happened. We have seen strikes in Iraq that have been blamed on Israel, where various Iranian allied proxies are being hit, where potentially attempts to bring advanced missiles into Iraq, those shipments are being hit. We had a situation recently where an Israeli drone hit part of the precision missile project of Hezbollah in Lebanon. I mean, what do we think this is just going to intensify even more in the year ahead? And is that going to become part of the electoral cycle in Israel, where security is going to become even more of an issue?
So I think there's two parts to that question. Will it intensify?
Yeah.
We essentially predict that it will continue. But again, neither side really wants to blow everything up.
Yeah.
And the risk of miscalculation is grave. And we've seen, efforts by Iran to play around in the Lebanese playground in terms of precision missiles. Israel earlier this year sent a very strong message that it would perhaps not be deterred from acting inside Lebanon.
Mm.
I think that has had an impact.
Yeah.
Israel continues to act in Syria.
Mm.
Depending on when this podcast comes out, something might blow up overnight.
Mm.
These things happen with no real warning, but they happen quite frequently. And then the real novelty of this past year, and Israel has acknowledged this publicly, strikes inside Iraq, which if you would go back even just a few years ago, you said the Israeli Air Force, presumably, is striking militias inside Iraq. That would have seemed a bit far-fetched.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Richard, I want to bring you in on this.
So I just wanted to add one of the things for looking for the year ahead. One of the crucial factors will be the role that Russia plays, and especially kind of in the Syrian theater that we've seen for now a couple of years. This deconfliction mechanism between the Israeli Air Force and the Russians based there to avoid any direct confrontation. We've seen after the last strike or two, kind of particularly a higher pitch of criticism from Russia, with Russia revealing some of the operational details that Israel used the Jordanian airspace and this sort of thing. And so there is an open question mark how long Russia, kind of with their eyes on kind of the end game in Syria, will continue to allow the Israeli Air Force to operate in that space. At the moment, the assessment is that Putin is holding firm on that deconfliction mechanism, but it's not a given that it will continue forever.
I mean, I want to ask another question also about the Israeli narrative about what's been going on in Syria. And one of the things that I was quite struck by was there was a real confidence around a lot of Israeli military officers and also politicians were saying, we've won this battle, that everything that Iran has tried to do in Syria, it has not been able to do. Like, it wanted to bring in advanced missiles, we stopped them. It wanted to set up a seaport, we stopped them, or the Russians stopped them. It wanted an air base, it didn't get it. It has not been able to do all the things that it wanted to do. And every time it tries to do something significant in terms of bringing assets in. Israel has the intelligence, it hits them hard, and, you know, it's a setback. But we're now in a sort of slightly new phase. As you said, the issue with Russia, the Assad regime is taking control of almost the entire country. We have a new defense minister, Naftali Bennett, who we've written about in the last few weeks, seems to be wanting to up the ante and really be even more proactive against Iranian assets in Syria. I mean, do you detect that the IDF narrative is going to become a bit more cautious, or do you think that they're going to run along with the political narrative? Do you think that we're going to see a greater intensity of that conflict, or do you think we'll see more of the same?
So this brings me to the second part of your earlier question,
yeah,
right? The Israeli political dynamic and what we might see going forward. We write in the report, the January to March timeframe is going to be, as they say, a bit cagey.
Yeah.
It's going to be a bit delicate because you have both a new defense minister, Naftali Bennett, who has made a lot of far-reaching promises that he's going to shift policy.
And knows he may only be there until March.
Right.
This could be his only time in that office.
And he's also, like everyone else, up for re-election in March. So he's been pushing for a more, shall we say, proactive strategy vis-a-vis primarily Syria, but not only. Mm. And it's a question of how the IDF itself and the senior defense establishment in Israel kind of try to hold the line. Because the risk of miscalculation, again, is high precisely in this January to March timeframe.
Yeah, Richard.
I would just add that, I mean, I'm not convinced that although Naftali Bennett serving as defence minister or kind of an acting defence minister in a transitional government has that much weight in kind of in really significantly changing the security policy which has now been kind of in place for the last 2 or 3 years. And I think to a large degree he will defer, first of all, to the experience of the prime minister that is leading it, but essentially to the heads of the security establishment, to the Mossad, the Shin Bet, and the IDF, which are really kind of setting the tone, at least in my assessment of the policy of striking that balance of kind of representing kind of the vital Israeli interests against the Iranian entrenchment, but balancing that against kind of a full on confrontation, which will escalate it further.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was going to say is that what's been very striking about sort of Israel's war with Iran in Syria over the last few years has been how little we have heard about anyone in the military or security establishment being in any way uncomfortable about what is happening. And it's clear that, you know, they would have a way of leaking stories or briefing journalists if they felt that in some way the politicians were trying to take them somewhere they didn't want to go. And we've heard none of that. Although we did hear from Gadi Eisenkot, the former chief of staff, who said he was unhappy, not necessarily with the operational aspect, he was unhappy with the way that Prime Minister Netanyahu and politicians had been talking up what they'd been doing, and they felt that removed Israel's deterrence because it sort of forced the other side to react, because you're shining a spotlight on what Israel's doing and talking a little bit about it too much. But Neri wanted to add.
No, I think you're both absolutely correct. But the subtext of what we're talking about is what is Netanyahu, the Prime Minister's decision-making process at the moment, and crucially in the January to March timeframe right before an election. You know, beginning this past summer, again, in election number two, in the midst of that election, you saw, like you said, James, this growing kind of public talk about what Israel was doing in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, something that you didn't see just a few years ago from senior Israeli officials. It was a lot of purposeful ambiguity. Ambiguity and tight lips. And what we've seen really over the past several months, coinciding, I would argue, with Netanyahu's increasingly delicate political and legal situation, is a loosening of these older restrictions. So the question really comes, moving forward into 2020, whether what Bennett is putting forward will be supported by the Prime Minister. A shift or not is debatable, but whether it's going to be supported by the Prime Minister and whether Bennett himself has cover to push through some of these changes.
I would just add that I don't think it's really that, in that aspect of the security policy is such a hot political question. If you look at, the for example, Benny Gantz and the Blue and White Party, they give the Prime Minister and kind of by default Bennett as well kind of complete support with regard to their policy in the north. That is to make the point that it's not the same in Gaza, where there is more striking criticism, and that is far more of a political issue. But in the north, I think that there is a consensus kind of from centre left, centre right of what the IDF are trying to achieve there.
Let's move on a little bit and talk about Israeli politics and what we think is going to happen. I mean, I was feeling quite bold when I was trying to sum up what we thought was going to take place next year, and agreed with what the rest of the team believe, which is that we think that this is going to be the moment where Bibi Netanyahu ends his political career, that the election will mean that he loses more support and somehow Benny Gantz emerges as prime minister. Are we confident? No, I say confident, but I mean, the predictions are always very difficult, but we seem that, you know, this has been a sort of slow motion departure by Benjamin Netanyahu, and do we think he's finally going to reach the exit door? Richard?
Well, I think there are quite a few more stages to go through between now and the election in March before we get there. I mean, we saw actually a fascinating announcement on the Israeli media this morning that said that even before the election, the Attorney General is going to make a ruling whether, now that the circumstances have changed and that the Prime Minister is formally under indictment, whether that status allows him to form a government. And whatever he decides, it's likely then to be appealed in the Supreme Court as well. My if we're going to make be making predictions, my sense is that it would be almost impossible for them to say that he can't stand. There may be a case that on the voting slip, unlike the September election, which kind of said specifically and deliberately that you're voting for the Likud under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu, it's not impossible that they could make a ruling. This is slightly granular, that you're only voting for the Likud and leaving Netanyahu's name off the ticket, which would then allow the flexibility if the legal proceedings were to be ratcheted up. But the challenge really is that Netanyahu is not going to go without a fight. Obviously, we're a week away from the primaries, although he's certainly expected to beat Gideon Saar in the leadership primaries within the Likud. And he's most likely to be the Likud candidate going forward. There are still another of these crossroads to go through. Mm-hmm. In terms of the challenges of the Likud party, they really have a fight against apathy. I mean, both parties have that. The whole political system is in a crisis now because of this third election, which we said, if we were talking a year ago and talking about the first election of 19, that this was a really a vote on Netanyahu's popularity. This is the third time that we're going for a rerun of the Bibi or no Bibi vote. And the question for both sides of that debate will be kind of how many people can you move across that line, and how much can you motivate Netanyahu's supporters to again come out and support him?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, Neri, do you want to...
No, I think it's true. Look, you have to predict. I think the reasonable assessment would be that Likud under Netanyahu loses enough votes where it makes Netanyahu's position at the top of Likud untenable. Mm. And so we write in the report that because of that loss in March, Netanyahu steps down and Gideon Saar, after a surprisingly robust performance in next week's Likud primary, is the lead candidate to replace Netanyahu at the top of Likud, and that enables both Blue and White and Likud to cut a deal for a national unity government with Benny Gantz as prime minister first, in a rotation deal with Gideon Saar. Mm. That's the big picture prediction, and then we go into kind of what that would mean for Israeli policy. We don't have to get into that right now, but sure, come March, it might be the end of Netanyahu. That's what a lot of people are saying, but that's why they play the game, and that's why they run the election.
I mean, the campaign will also be very interesting because, you know, if you look closely at what happened in March and September, I mean, it seemed that Benjamin Netanyahu's magic was not having its usual effect, and he was playing a lot of the same tunes, but they weren't really, you know, hitting the right note with the audience. And, you know, you saw a big promise to... apply Israeli sovereignty rather to all Israeli settlements. He did that in April, leading up to the September election. He promised to apply Israeli sovereignty to the Jordan Valley, and that didn't seem to have an impact. And Likud lost votes, so there was a sense there that either they thought he was safe and they like didn't need to vote for him, and that all his protestations that the right was going to collapse unless people voted for him. For whatever reason, they didn't turn out. They weren't turned on by this idea that, you know, all these annexations or applying Israeli sovereignty was going to take place. I don't know what he's going to pull out the bag for March, but there's certainly a sense in terms of the cycle that that kind of power to really mobilize the electorate is waning. I mean, would you agree with that?
Netanyahu is a master at political campaigns. He's a master kind of political strategist. But I think that's right. In the last fall's election, I think he miscalculated the level of hysteria and the level of almost right-wing desperation that he could mobilize for his cause to get people out. And what we saw was the opposite. Likud under Netanyahu, as well as the wider right-wing bloc, actually lost a lot of votes. Now we can get into a whole debate about why, but I think fundamentally the past year is a good example where people are, I think, already pricing in a post-Netanyahu Israel. And once that dam breaks, once that barrier is breached, it's very difficult, I would argue, to get it back. And so Netanyahu can get up tomorrow and make all kinds of promises. I think it's an open question how much of the Israeli public will believe what he has to say.
Yeah. Well, I think one of Netanyahu's greatest successes this time around, which has basically brought us into this deadlock, was tying in the rest of the right-wing bloc to support him. And I think there's a big question mark with whether both the right-wing parties, the ideological right-wing parties, and the religious parties will make that same calculation again. That I think as part of this, the mood music going on is that they understand that maybe not necessarily they want to tie their wagon so clearly and definitively to the Likud and to Netanyahu. And of course, I mean, it's in previous political generations, we've seen the ultra-Orthodox parties in particular act as a third way in Israeli politics, who have been prepared to sit in centre-left governments in the past.
But a long time ago, it's been a while.
It has been a long time. Yeah. It had a long time, but what matters to that constituency, if we're being kind of crude about it, is the kind of his self-interest and funding for their families and for their educational institutes. It's a matter of political a political price to pay to bring them in and to wean them off the block, and that will be very interesting to see if that.
I'd also make the reverse argument. How many potential Likud voters, or let's say moderate right wing voters that in the past have voted Likud, are going to be put off by this growing embrace by Netanyahu and vice versa of the ultra-Orthodox, of the far-right settler parties. That could also act as a repellent at the ballot box, while it, you know, undoubtedly has helped Netanyahu in coalition governments.
I mean, there's an argument. I mean, I'm kind of fresh from, you know, all the impact of the British elections, and there's an argument that, you know, the blue and white could run a smart, simple campaign where they capitalize on the frustration with the political deadlock, the frustration that Netanyahu has been indicted but seems to be around forever, even though he's essentially not managed to form a coalition twice. And they could run a very coherent, simple campaign where they're just like, you know, just go, let's end the deadlock, let's have a proper government, you know, and that could swing some voters to blue and white. And that, you know, they are now, and an interesting point I think that some of the blue and white people would make, which is that they started out as, you know, the sort of amateur political athletes, as you like. Benny Gantz was new to politics, and a lot of people said, a lot of people, him and his party were novices. And they've now essentially, you know, they've run two marathons and they're going to run a third. And so you would think they've been getting good at this now. You know, more battle hardened than a lot of, you know, other parties in some ways that have tried to enter new. So that there's a chance that maybe they'll win over a lot of those voters. What do we think?
I think the chances are great that happens.
Yeah.
You know, we have to remember they are veterans of two and now an upcoming third election campaign. They didn't run the greatest campaigns, even they would admit it.
Do you think they're getting better? Was the second one better than the first?
I think how they handled the coalition talks over the past 2 or 3 months was by leaps and bounds better than the campaigns they ran
right
during the actual
election. They're improving.
So they're improving as politicians. I think that's that's undoubtedly true.
Yeah.
They kept together. They kept overall kind of message discipline.
Yeah.
Despite certain, you know,
And Benny Gantz has dropped Yair Lapid as his sort of, you know, rotation running mate, and that well, gives them a bit more clearer leadership, doesn't it?
Some would argue that Lapid relinquished it,
right?
Because it served the greater good,
right?
As opposed to Gantz jettisoning
fair enough
the position,
yeah.
But no, that will also help them. Yeah. Gantz is the clear prime ministerial candidate. One to one against Netanyahu. Gantz himself, over the past few months, has looked and acted more prime ministerial. That will be an asset. And again, going back to the kind of, I don't want to call it a fear barrier, but a crossing of a certain Rubicon, the Israeli public is getting used to the idea of someone else helming the country other than Bibi Netanyahu.
Yeah. Final question. I know that this is a very difficult one to call, but in terms of what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, and, you know, we talk about in our paper about there being potential elections for the Palestinian legislature that could take place in February, that there's more of the same in terms of Israel and Hamas, that, you know, they may or may not agree a wider deal. I mean, what's your quick take on the situation with the West Bank and Gaza? Are we just going to see more of the same? I mean, we say every year, Mahmoud Abbas, he's been in power for ages. Is he going to relinquish his post? The smart money seems to be no. Hamas and Israel and Gaza, smart money would just say more of the same. I mean, what do you reckon?
I mean, yeah, from my perspective, I think more of the same is probably the safest is probably the safest bet. I remember meeting with a Palestinian pollster that made the point that just stuck with me, that said, you know, that the Palestinian people like nothing more than to talk about the idea of unity, but both sides in practice have no kind of roadmap really to deliver it and be able to crucially to implement it. So whilst it stays a watchword and useful soundbite and kind of takes the pressure off, I mean, they see Israelis next door going to the ballot for the third time in 12 months and realize that they haven't done it for over 12 years. So the contrast is striking, but the short answer is no, I don't see any change.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. In the report, we effectively dismissed the notion that the Palestinians will get it together to actually hold at least parliamentary elections this coming year, despite a lot of talk over the past few months to that effect. We also, with regard to Gaza, are very down on the possibility of Israel and Hamas actually concluding this long-term ceasefire arrangement. We do argue that certain easing measures with regard to Gaza will be moving forward, and and these indirect talks between Israel and Hamas will move forward, no matter what government is in power in Israel, by the way. But a kind of grand deal remains elusive, I think precisely because Hamas and Israel can't come to terms over this prisoner swap. And in terms of the West Bank, I think, yeah, as Richard said, more of the same until Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, decides otherwise, or is forced, I would argue, biologically more than politically, to exit the stage.
Final question, which I know is a really difficult question, but let's just dwell on Trump for a moment, Donald Trump. And he's going to go into this election campaign, and he's, you know, obviously wants to win. He doesn't have that many foreign policy achievements, although he believes, obviously, he has many. Do we think that Trump is going to make, like, his Iran policy, withdrawing from the nuclear deal, maximum pressure, all this stuff, and all the things he thinks he's done that are great for Israel, like moving the embassy, U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and recognizing the Golan, Israeli sovereignty of the Golan? Is he going to make huge play of all these things and talk them up as his major achievements and make all sorts of grand promises about the future? Or is he going to just play a domestic election? What's your sense, Neri, particularly someone who's a close observer of the U.S. politics?
No, I would say Trump is going to be more focused on domestic issues.
Right.
And by the way, I think that's more in his nature, and I think that's where the American public is at.
Yeah.
And we should also mention that many of his potential Democratic challengers are also heavily focused domestically and not necessarily all that different from him in terms of foreign policy instinct, shall we say. But no, I think the fact that it is an election year for Trump and for America will I believe kind of rein in some of the grander impulses of maybe certain officials in the Trump administration. I don't see Trump going off on foreign adventures a few months before Americans have to go to the ballot box.
Sure.
When, as you put it, in his mind, everything has been going so well.
Yes.
And he should be reelected.
Yes. And the so-called, so, you know, the Trump plan for Israeli-Palestinian talks, are yet again for the second year, we are saying that we will not see that plan. And I think, you know, certainly for the foreseeable future, that will remain a theoretical proposition rather than something that actually gets printed out and shared. And that's definitely our view, isn't it?
Yes, we predict that as well. We were fairly comfortable with that prediction, I should mention.
Mm.
But yeah, the deal of the century, we might have to wait till the next century.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. That was a really good sweeping analysis. And thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, then please do review us on iTunes and give us some feedback. Let us know. Message us on Twitter or Facebook and tell us what you'd like to hear more about in the future. But for now, and for the last podcast of 2019, we will say goodbye and thank you for listening, and we'll be back again in January with more great guests. Thank you very much for listening.